Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Live from Roberto's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue at heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady Sue. And what do I do when I'm not hosting Word of Mouth? I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations you hear on my show, and working with my clients, which include chefs, somms, big brands, and startups, all those doing what's most delicious and innovative. And today's in-studio guest on hashtag People We Like. Later on, we'll welcome Leia Cohen, former Top Chef finalist. She's cooked all over Italy and Asia before starting Pig and Cow, a Filipino/Thai/other Asian food delicious spot in the Lower East Side. And before that, we'll head to the Green Market with Chop champion Chef Sean Scottis. He's also a mutual friend of Leia's and me, myself. That was not planned. And after that, we'll settle in with Chef Leia. And after we talk to Chef Leia this morning, we will wind it down with Matt Conway, sommelier and GM of Marc Forgione Restaurant. First, let's go to the Green Market. I'm at the Union Square Green Market with Sean Scottis. He was the Chopped champion on the Halloween 2012 episode and has been invited back to compete again on Chopped Champions, maybe 16 of over 100 something other Chopped champs. And he's about to sign on a place to open a hot pot concept called Ghost Street.
Yes.
Hey.
How are you?
Thanks nice for having to me. See you.
Yeah, nice to see you too.
Thanks for joining me.
Very welcome.
Hot pot. Okay. It sounds like it's hot and it's all in a pot. What is it exactly?
Yes. So hot pot has a lot of different iterations, but the one that is most common is a pot of liquid boiling away at the middle of the table, most often spicy and or split into two flavors. And the whole premise is you take these beautiful, raw, fresh ingredients, you dunk them in the liquid, the broth, for any given amount of time until they're cooked how you like it, and you dip it in the sauce and enjoy.
Oh, it's so good.
It's so good. It's great for large groups. It's so fun.
And I just want to highlight here that the pots that have the two sides, it's literally like a yin and yang. It's in fact very Chinese looking. There is a divider, and sometimes the divider can be curved, so yeah. It literally looks like a yin and yang. And one side is often spicy and the other side is not. So it's like, you know, we Chinese people like to have everything that we could ever want to eat on the table, and that is like bounty, and that's just our culture, so it's a really beautiful thing.
Yes.
So are you going to get those yin and yang pots?
Ours are going to be straight split.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks.
No curvature.
I'll get it for you next Christmas.
Yeah.
Or this Christmas.
Yeah. So we're opening a hot pot restaurant that's going to be called Ghost Street, and it's the name is derived from the dining area in the center, the capital of China, Beijing. So it's very fun. It's a magical place. There's hundreds of restaurants in a row. A lot of them are open 24 hours. You can get so many different things there. It's kind of a smorgasbord of Chinese delights. And we have an offer on the table right now on a spot. So we're, you know, fingers crossed, going to be sharing some very exciting information really soon.
It's my kind of food. I'm very excited. What are you cooking these days? You know, you don't have a restaurant yet, and probably right. Doing some cooking at home. What's exciting?
Yeah, you know, as we were saying quickly earlier, fall vegetables are not necessarily the sexiest out of the whole year, but there's a lot of big flavors right now, and you kind of end up with the root vegetables. It's parsnips, it's celery root, it's the earthy, you know, deep, delicious flavors that come from the ground.
You have a weakness for parsnips.
Yeah, I just think that they're underrepresented. They are very versatile. They are like piney carrots with a little celery mixed in, and you can cook them to make soup. You can braise them with whatever you like. Roast them in the oven. That's a very easy way to do it. I personally like them as chips. I think that if you slice them thin, fry them until they're crispy, and then garnish it with whatever kind of chili salt or five spice sugar mix that you like, it's a very, very excellent garnish for a salad, a soup, anything, congee, whatever you would happen to enjoy.
Yum.
Yeah.
Would you incorporate something like parsnips into hot pot, even though I don't, I didn't have parsnips as a Chinese kid eating hot pot at home?
Right, right. I mean, you could. I think that you would probably end up leaning a little bit more towards the lotus root. Taro is an amazing root vegetable to cook in hot pot. You can get potato in there, but I would have to say taro or lotus root is probably the most desirable root vegetable.
But in fact, you could throw in anything you want in hot pot, and hot pot is that blank canvas, so...
Absolutely, that's the beauty of it. I mean, you can really cater a meal to how you like to eat. It can be all vegetables, it can be all meat, it can be whatever you like, whatever you're in the mood for that day, and it can be different every time, so it doesn't get old.
Where are you from?
I grew up in Cleveland. I've been in New York for about the last 10 years, but coming originally from Cleveland, Ohio.
And what made the hot pot the thing that you actually want to do?
I lived in China a couple years ago for a summer, and I found myself going back to the hot pot restaurants, even when it was 100 degrees outside, multiple times a week. And I was just so in love with it that I came back and I started looking around, and we were going out to hot pot restaurants here, and the idea just kind of clicked. It was a very natural progression, and we're really excited to do it. I mean, I can't wait to share the hot pot with everybody.
where before the hot pot? Where did you cook before you wanted to start your own place?
When I moved to New York, I opened up a restaurant with Michael Simon called Perea, which was a great learning experience. And then I made up my mind at that point that I wanted to be a part of openings only. So from there, I opened a restaurant with Drew Nieport called My House in Tribeca, a place called Bar Q with Anita Lowe. And then I did a series of banh mi and pho restaurants that we opened up a chain of them quickly, four or five locations in a row. So I've always been pursuing these openings because I feel like the experience is exponential at that point. It's so much better to be able to develop a system than just assimilate with one that already exists. Mm-hmm. And the knowledge that you get from that is, 1 year of opening a restaurant is like 3 or 4 years working at a place that already has been open.
So for this Caucasian kid from Cleveland, Ohio, we may see parsnip chips...
congee garnish
on the congee, parsnips in the soup instead of taro root or with the taro root. I mean, I'm really excited. You really could throw anything in there.
Yeah, no, that's the beauty of it, is you get to really respond to the season. So in the summer and spring, you're going to have this bounty of leafy greens and everything else, and then as the season kind of tapers off, you go towards the heartier things, and you can supplement that with noodles and tofu and mushrooms,
Watch out. I want to get some lamb and a goat and some funky meats in there.
Yeah, some tendon, little tripe.
Yay. Yeah. So watch out for Ghost Street coming to theaters
Brooklyn.
Near you in 2014.
Yes.
If
absolutely.
All goes well, which
absolutely.
It will.
Absolutely, yeah.
Godspeed.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the studio. That was Sean Scotese. We're looking forward to his hot pot spot. That's Ghost Street. I'm your host, Leyte Su, and you're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on heritageradionetwork.org. And I'd love for you to tell me what you think. You can tweet at me, hashtag WOMSHOW, that's WOMSHOW, at heritage_radio. At Leyte Su, LEITIHSU, and I'm going to throw in at Chef Leia Cohen, that's Chef LEAHCOHEN, for later on when we welcome her in just a minute. It's been kind of the month of Asian food on word of mouth. I mean, we had Chef Pet from Kyo, John Daly from New York Sushi Co., Matt Gross dialed in live from Taiwan, Matt Gross from Bon Appetit, and then And then Leia Cohen this morning, we're going to talk to her about what it was like to grow up as a Jewapino in Scarsdale, New York. But I am Asian, so didn't mean to, but yeah, like, tell me what you think. Asian food, I think we've moved past that, you know, last year was the year of hipster Asian dining, but it's kind of just here to stay. It's the stuff that we are able to eat every day, lighter, healthier, umami full. So now for people we like. I'm pleased then to introduce former Top Chef finalist Leia Cohen, who's cooked all over Italy and Asia before opening up her very own spot called Pig and Cow, but it's not spelled cow, not C-O-W, but K-H-A-O. In the Lower East Side, she's also a CIA grad, but before that she was kind of a, you know, she kind of flunked out of school. you know, so she found her passion and her calling in life, which is what we hope for all of ourselves. So Deshaun Scotese, our mutual friend, know your story about you going to get hot pot in Taiwan?
No, I actually don't think that I ever told him.
Okay, it's just a great, story. So, one of your food adventures when you were traveling in Asia.
Of my food adventures when I was traveling in Taiwan was, I actually was there for Chinese New Year. Some of my friends that I met in Hong Kong were there, and I met them. And after a night of partying and getting wasted, I went back home to the hotel and realized that I was starving. So I stumbled around walking the streets and found this little hole-in-the-wall place, and it was this amazing hot pot spot. And then I ate my face off, went home, slept it off, and then didn't remember until like 3 p.m. the next day that I actually ate hot pot. And then I was like, oh my God, that was so amazing. And I kept trying, like, for the next few days to find the restaurant where I ate this infamous hot pot at 3 in the morning, and I could not find it. And I think it was one of those things where you have to get drunk again in order to, like, retrace your steps and then find out where. I mean, or it was maybe one of those places that was, like, only open after midnight or something like that, and I was looking for it at, like, 6 p.m. I don't know, but it was amazing, and I still crave it to this day.
It's like, it's Ghost Street. It's Ghost Street.
It's Ghost Street.
Wow, hear that? What was it like growing up as a Jewapino? Your mom is Filipino.
Yeah.
Your dad is
Jewish.
Jewish.
Yeah. I mean, it was great for me coming up, you know, having different cultures, like my mom's side of the family. And then my dad's side of the family, I got a lot of nagging from both sides, you know, the Asian mom and then the Jewish side of the family. But it was really great. I got to experience, you know, a lot of different things that most people don't get to experience. And I'm very much, I kind of gravitate more towards the Filipino side, even though I look Jewish. And no one believes the fact that I'm Filipino just by looking at me. But yeah, I mean, it was a really great experience having such a diverse upbringing.
So you grew up in Scarsdale, which, if for folks out there who maybe don't live in New York or don't know Scarsdale, the unusual place that it is, it's...
Yeah, Scarsdale is a suburb right outside of Manhattan, and it's great because it's so close to the city, but it also is a suburb, and you have the best of both worlds.
It's kind of richy rich.
Certain places are richy rich.
Yep.
And certain places are super ghetto. But yeah, I mean, I love where I grew up, and actually a lot of people now are moving outside of the city and opening up restaurants in Westchester and, like, on the Hudson. So I wouldn't mind maybe in the future opening up a place over there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's not that much good food, but there are a lot of people who like to eat and come into the city. So if they could have a restaurant, like a New York City restaurant in their backyard, I think it would do really well.
So... I saw this article, and I won't even name where it's from, but it was just a headline said, "Smiles and sisig." And I know you smile a lot, and I know you serve sisig, which is a Filipino sizzling pork dish over pork dish over rice. But it made me wince a little bit because it was really cute. Too cute.
I didn't see that. Where was that?
I don't even want to call it out. I mean, I don't. Yeah.
Oh.
I forget which one. I just kind of. I scour the web before. I take good care of my guests. So okay. I do like a lot of. Now I know everything about you. Oh. Besides the fact that we chatted.
Yeah.
So Asian food, and then I think you know, there's like last year there was like Asian hipster food. All these. Tying Asian with hipsters, and then you know I had spoken to a friend who had been a sous chef at one of the fine dining places, the multi-starred places, where a chef that we all would have heard of in private conversations pulled him aside and was like, hey, so what about what's up with that Asian hipster stuff that's going on in Brooklyn? So I mean, you look just as hipster as I do. I mean, we are sitting in Bushwick. I mean, in your words, like, what's next? We've come kind of a long way. It's no longer, I don't know, I don't want to use the word fetishized either, but it's no longer Asian hipster food.
I mean, yeah, I don't think it's Asian hipster food. Well, I mean, it still is. but I think a lot more, I think people thought it was a trend that might die down, and mm-hmm. I think it's just, you know, starting to get more... more interest and people every I mean
and more interesting
yeah. There's so many different types of Asian cuisine. It's such a broad, you know, like topic, and there are so many places. I mean, you had Chef Pet on here. Mm-hmm. I went to his restaurant 2 weeks ago and I thought it was slamming. And so that's just like another different region of Laos that's people aren't doing. And you know, I think there's so many other different countries that people are gonna try to do and try to expose people, and like, so I think Asian hipster is here to stay. Hipsters are here to stay, and so are the Asians. So yeah,
my show is really just thinly disguised, like sort of auditions for my Taiwanese beef stew noodle.
Oh yeah,
place.
You keep talking about that. I gotta try this infamous beef noodle stew.
Come to my ladies. We do a food ladies potluck. If you're a food lady, you are invited. The next one is at my apartment. It's in collaboration with Aaron Fairbanks, the executive director of this place, of not Roberto's, but Heritage Radio. It's always the best gals, and you know, if you can get out of the kitchen,
yeah,
to come help me in my kitchen. I've already recruited like other people.
Okay, you know? Cool.
It takes a village to raise a pot of soup. So, all right, so. Let's see. We're going to rewind back into, I mean, you have this notoriety for something that's hilarious to be sort of notorious for and notable for, which is that maybe you were the only Top Chef contestant in the history of Top Chefs. And we didn't do the research. We didn't, like, watch every single episode of Top Chef and try to Google Top Chef. But to have a showmance.
Oh, yeah. The good old days when I made out with someone on TV. I believe I was the only one caught on camera doing that. But many of other people behind the scenes have definitely made out. I was the only one who was dumb enough to get caught.
Do they like stick a camera in your, like, how do they catch you?
Well, I mean, mine was, I had some sort of relationship with Jose. I mean, he was the person that I got along with the most, and so it was this whole, it became like a storyline, of course. But no, I mean, we were really good friends, mm-hmm. and he's the guy, I'm a girl.
Yeah.
We were drinking, and, you know, we made out.
Yeah. Well, was it sort of, it's, you know, and I hate to put it this way because I'm, it's like, okay, I learned this trick from my friend Christy Harrison, who was a former editor at Gourmet, and that's when we worked together, but she now has a food psych podcast. And I learned this trick from her, which is she goes, Mom and Dad, plug your ears right now.
Like, yeah.
Right now, plug your ears. Or don't listen to this episode and that episode.
Yeah.
But I'm never the person to, you know, judge or hold back. You know, you do what you want to, but this is the funny question is, was it worth it? Like, looking, I mean, not so much the makeup, but maybe the makeup. But.
Oh, yeah, he was an amazing kiss.
Oh, really?
No, I'm just kidding. No, I actually don't even remember.
You were also drunk.
I was also, I mean, yeah, we were drunk pretty much the whole time that we were filming. Like, they give you beer. They want you to be drunk. So, I mean, not when you're cooking, but like when you're stewing and you're waiting for deliberations and all that fun stuff.
You're stewing like for real stewing or stewing like
no, like waiting. Okay. They call it like the stew room and like you have to wait for deliberations and all that stuff. I mean, do I regret it? Yes. I came across, like, as a home wrecker on national television.
But both homes are wrecks, so it's sort of, like, really unfair.
But it wasn't just my fault, though.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I regret it, of course. You know, no one wants to be cheated on national television, and that was not the kind of press that I wanted to get, and I didn't want to be remembered for it, but... I mean, at this point, it was so long ago, like, get over it.
Yeah, totally. No, totally. You know what I mean? Just hilarious, like, because from a, you know, that we had the Time Gods piece that came out, which, like, you know, it's, I think you and I kind of came to the same conclusion. Well, you know, I read it.
Yeah.
Just because, actually, a friend of mine did the flowchart, and, of course, Heritage Radio was thinking about sort of the right way to cover it that's not reactionary.
Right.
But it's a bigger picture conversation. It's sort of like what I find interesting is sort of more than merit in the kitchen is sort of the, you know, being a woman who fends off unwanted come-ons or there's...
Oh,
you know,
dirty old chefs who hit on you when you're a young girl.
Yes, exactly. There's just other... And it's, you know, what advice would you give? You know, what I tell my mentee gals is, like, you know, like the don't shit where you eat thing.
Yeah, I mean, the don't shit where you eat thing is a really good piece of advice. Unfortunately, in the restaurant industry, everyone shits where they eat.
Yeah.
It's just you're in such close quarters and you're around the same people all the time. It's not uncommon for a work romance to... start. But what I will say to anyone, any younger female chefs, try to avoid it. I mean, with line cooks, like other people that you work with, it's, I guess it's fine. It's like inevitable that it will happen.
Yep.
But for higher people, you know, who are your bosses or higher up, it's never a good look. So
it's pretty sticky.
Yeah.
To navigate this.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, you as a gal and then Hosea went on to win that season, right? Mm-hmm. So it's funny how all the press and all the comments and the blogs were so nasty towards you.
Oh,
and
yeah. People hated on me, like, hard.
And then he went on to be the winner, and he was all good.
He went on to be the winner. I mean, I think people still hated on him, but then he won the show, so it was kind of his redemption or something. You know what I mean? Like, he redeemed himself by winning the show, and then I was not a winner, obviously. Yep. So... Yeah.
And then so, yeah, you've had a lot of roller coaster rides in your very, you know, super fascinating career. You're a PR company. You have a PR company now, right?
No, we actually don't.
Oh, you don't anymore? Okay.
No, not anymore.
So, but you probably learned a thing or two about PR in yourself.
Yeah. I mean, first of all... I need to think before I speak a lot of the times, because sometimes what I really want to say is not what I should say. And yeah, I'm very open. I'm an open book, and people ask me my opinion on things, and I just kind of blurt out whatever it is that I think of at the time. And then my PR woman will be like, okay, so maybe you should have said that. Maybe you should have kind of like thought about it. And like, I sometimes need someone to be there with me by my side when I have interviews, just to be like, no, that's not what she meant.
Just grab you.
Be like, shut up, bitch. Stop talking arm. Like that. But, I mean, yeah, it's hard to kind of think whatever you can say the public is going to hear and then form opinions or whatever actions you do. You know, people are paying attention to you as much as... you like it or not, you are in the public view to a certain extent, and you just have to be cautious and aware of what and how you behave.
Or you also could just go to Asia.
Or I could just move to Asia where no one knows who I am and it's amazing and I can do whatever I want.
And continue your learning, which was, I think, a really sharp move on your part.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I like to learn cuisines is moving to the country. So I, as you said, I lived in Italy. Mm-hmm. And I lived in Italy for like a year and a half, and I immersed myself in that cuisine and that culture.
And cooked at a Michelin star restaurant, La Madia.
La Madia in Sicily, which is amazing. And to this day, I really want to go back, but I just haven't gotten the chance to. And then after the whole Top Chef thing, I moved and worked for Chentra for a year. And then I moved to Southeast Asia, and it was kind of like a, I'm just going to pack my bags and go and do this. And it was like the best experience that I've ever had. And I'm going back to Asia in February. I'm very excited. I'm going to go visit Burma and try to learn some Burmese food. Mm. Or is it called Myanmar now? I don't know. Burma or Myanmar. It's the same thing.
It's really hard to, you know, sort of, you know, swing your like politics, geography.
Yeah.
Dick around. I think it's called like
Burmese,
right.
Burmese food, but the...
Is it
Myanmar? Called Myanmar?
Okay, let's
I don't know.
Here.
Anyway, I'm going to there for I'm going there for a few, like I think a week or two, and then I'm going to Thailand and the Philippines again. So,
Thailand and the Philippines.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Favorite country to cook in, and I think it's fun that you went high and low.
Yeah.
Like grandma and then Michelin.
Yeah, I mean, I did mom and pop places in Thailand, little hole in the wall places, countryside places, and then I worked, I staged with David Thompson, who's an amazing chef, and then I staged with his sous chef who opened a restaurant in Bangkok as well, so I got all the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to take a really quick break here, have a couple of quick announcements of stuff that I'm super excited about. I went to the friends and family of Fung Tu in the Lower East Side. This is Chef Jonathan Wu, formerly of Per Se. He's teaming up with Namwa Tea Parlor's Wilson Tang to offer a very, very personal and creative interpretation of Chinese food. And, you know, just to mention two dishes on the menu that you definitely must get. One of them is... You know, I forget what the exact what it's called. The word dumplings is in there somewhere, but it feels like mapo tofu sauce all over some spitzel type of like delicious carby. I'm not gonna say chunks. I'm making your food sound terrible, Jonathan, but it's delicious. I mean, it's so. Of course, you'd want to have mapo tofu over something that's silky and comforting, and instead of tofu, there's a spetzel like stuff. And so that seems like it is so apropos to the Lower East Side right now, and it is. But it actually has this recipe has roots in olden times China. You know, Jonathan did his research. This is an old recipe. So that's incredible. The other dish that's just simple and ridiculous is raw bok choy, beautiful leaves of bok choy laid over a plate, and then you use that bok choy to dip it into a shrimp paste that Jonathan makes, like from scratch. He makes shrimp paste from scratch. It's you have to have it to understand it. It's like what I want to snack on when I'm watching the Super Bowl, even though I don't really watch the Super Bowl, but you know, it's kind of the kind of thing that I want to snack on when I'm sitting on the couch, even though I don't sit on the couch. All right, so it's like something I just want to eat all the time. And tonight I'm finally going to get the chance to check out Contra, Lower East Side again. I know there's so much stuff going on Lower East Side right now. It's like the new Williamsburg. Chef Jeremiah Stone, pastry chef Fabian von Hosk, and then sommelier Linda Milagros Villalogo. She actually has a really fascinating background. She sommed all over the world, including the Michelin-starred Mugaritz in San Sebastian, Spain. $55 tasting menu, just $55. Check it out and follow my updates on Twitter. I'll be updating y'all on how that goes. And after a really, really quick commercial break, we'll continue talking to Leah Cohen here in the studio about some key career moves cooking with
Amberell and cooking with Daniel Hum.
You are listening to Percolatin' by Obesity on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Stay tuned for more Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue.
The National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hey, welcome back to the studio. You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. In the studio, we have Leah Cohen, chef owner of Pig and Cow on the Lower East Side, former top chef. Hi, Leah.
Hey.
Welcome back. All right, so let's talk some of the folks that you've, you know, gotten to work with in your career. You know, it felt like TV changed you, not just outwardly, not just, you know, sort of in the public eye, mm-hmm. but like inside it did something to you. Once you came back, everything was a little bit different.
Well, I mean, going on the show was a really big learning experience. Mm-hmm. I like to say it was kind of like boot camp of some sorts. It makes you think a lot differently and make and solve problems and make you just more, I think, also confident and be able to adapt to situations easier. I mean, it was one of the hardest things that I've had to do. It feels like such a long time ago talking about it. It was like so long ago. But it definitely helped change me as a person and as a chef, and it made me more confident. And it just, you know.
Well, so before you went on the show, you mm-hmm. were working with Amberell at Centro
Vinoteca.
And then you came back, and then you sort of made some changes.
Yeah, I mean, Anne was kind of on her way out of Centro because she got her show, Secrets of a Restaurant Chef.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to take over her position as executive chef, which was a really great promotion and step upwards for my career. So that was, I mean, that was a really great opportunity that was provided to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then going back, you know, another step, you had worked in the kitchens of, kitchen of 11 Madison Park.
Yeah.
You had a funny sort of interview experience. It's almost like they threw a Top Chef-like sort of twist.
Like a quick fire challenge in your face? Yeah. So after, when I got back from Italy, I trailed in a bunch of restaurants trying to figure out which I wanted to work in next. And 11 Madison Park was the last restaurant that I trailed at and obviously took the job there. But at the end of the trail, one of the sous chefs was like, okay, so this is our family meal shelf. We have a bunch of ingredients and we want you to cook a dish that best represents you and your cooking style. You have 45 minutes and then you can, you know, present it to me and the other sous chefs. And at that point,
I was like freaking out because I'd never been asked, you know, to like cook a meal for a sous chef on a trail. It was like the oddest thing to me, and I was like kind of hyperventilating and like freaking out, and I was just like, oh my god, because I really enjoyed the stage that day, and I wanted to get the job, and it all worked out fine because I worked there for a year. But it was, I mean, I think that's a really good way to kind of weed out the people who suck.
Yep.
to make them, you know, cook some food for you. And even if it's not like the best, I don't even remember what I made. Obviously, it wasn't horrible because I got the job, but it's a really good way to see the skill level of the people that are coming into the kitchen.
Yeah, your memory is lacking, though.
I smoked way too much pot when I was younger, so I have a really bad memory.
Because that would have really been the cherry on top of the story. You know, I'm, as a journalist, I'm hurting inside a little bit. We have to go to ask like the sous chef you worked for.
I know. Well, he actually is in Seattle now. He has. Jason Franey.
I met him in Chicago.
Yeah.
He's so wonderful.
He's awesome. Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah. There's the EMP
family tree
has, speaking of family trees, family tree sort of, it's surprising.
Yeah.
It's like, wow.
Yeah.
So what was the experience like for you working with Daniel Hum and,
Daniel Hum was amazing. He is, you know, very, very talented. That kitchen was very, very hard.
Okay, give me an anecdote. Something, I mean, so it's hard for maybe people who, believe it or not, there are people in the world who don't cook. And there are people in the world who don't cook
what's wrong
professionally.
With them?
So what is that like? Is there like a particular instance?
I mean, well, Daniel Hum is a perfectionist, so everything has to be perfect, and if it's not, you have to remake it. And there's just, you know, a high level of he requires it to be perfect, and I would freak out before service because I just wanted everything. A, I had to get everything done, and I had to make sure that it was at the level that he wanted it to be done. And it's just a high-pressure environment. I don't know how it is now, but when I was working there, you know, there's always someone who would be there to take your spot if you fucked up.
Mm-hmm. You were kind of, you know, you're fairly friendly, and it's funny when you mentioned that you were, people were surprised at how quiet you became during your entire time there.
Well, not the entire time, but the first time. So on my trail,
first time, okay.
I was, you know, like super talkative and like friendly with everyone. And then I got the job, and I, for the first month, I like did not speak at all, which is the weirdest thing because like most times people need to tell me to shut up. but I did not talk for a whole month, and people were like, what is wrong with you? And I was like, I was just focused. I wanted to make sure, you know, I didn't get yelled at or I didn't mess anything up. And it was, you know, I wanted to do a good job. So it was just, I was focused. And then after that, I like, you know, loosened up, and then Daniel would be like getting mad at me because I was talking too much. I told you yesterday, like, I don't have a mentor, but I guess if I were to have a mentor, he would definitely be my mentor in like the earlier stages of my career.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds like you guys need to have a coffee.
I know.
Mentor, mentee coffee.
He's awesome.
So speaking of your bad memory, you had opted to leave University of Arizona. I'm just going to like call you right out.
Oh yeah.
But really it was because you were about to flunk
out.
With like a,
I mean, I don't know if I was going to flunk out, but I had like a 1.8 GPA. I lived in Arizona, so the weather was gorgeous. There was like pools everywhere all over campus, so I would rather like go sun tanning and like work on my tan instead of going to class. And and I was partying a lot.
But there were moments in your childhood where you may not remember it, however your friends remember that you'd whip up some good stuff, and there were moments of early brilliance.
Yeah, I mean, apparently I have always enjoyed cooking, and none of my friends from growing up don't find it surprising that I made a career out of cooking. But for me, I mean, when everyone asks, like, in interviews, so why, what got you interested in food? I mean, like, I should really have a rehearsed, like, good story, because I really don't have one because I don't remember. But I guess I always cooked from a young age. I mean, I know my parents, they were working, like, all the time, so I would just, like, try to make stuff for me and my brother to eat. And like, we had no food in the house because, and I'm kind of the same way now, like, my dad loves to snack, so he didn't want a lot of food in the house because he didn't want to be fat. So we would only have like canned tuna or canned tomatoes, and I mean, I always had a pot of rice. Obviously, from an Asian mother, we always had rice in the house. So I would make, like, fried rice, or, like, make tomato sauce with pasta and stuff like that. I think that's pretty good for, like, a 10-year-old to be cooking that kind of stuff.
And,
like,
and bulgogi.
Oh, yeah. And my best friend, she was Korean, and I would always go to her house. And her mom would be cooking bulgogi, and I, like, asked if I could help her and ask her all the secrets and how she made the bulgogi and, like, eating the kimchi and all that fun stuff. So, yeah.
Excellent. So, last question for you. You know, it's been a roller coaster ride. Now you've got you've got a great boyfriend whom I've met. Your restaurant is now over a year old. Things are, you know, really coming together. And have you learned a thing or two about picking the people in your life, both personally and professionally?
I mean, yeah. Picking whoever, partners, boyfriends, friends in your life, I mean, it's all a learning experience, you know. People have, obviously, you pick people for a reason, and there are positives and negatives, and, you know, you just have to...
What's a warning sign, or what's, like, something that you've learned to not do?
I don't know, because I keep doing it.
I'm sure your boyfriend's loving
it. Oh, no. I mean, no, my boyfriend is great. He, yeah, he's good. But, I mean, yeah, it's just everything is a learning process. And I think, you know, you have to make the best learning experience is making mistakes and learning from that and then not doing it again. Yeah. Yep.
And then what I've learned, by the way, is that there's a whole world of mistakes. So then even if you don't make the same set of these 10 mistakes, there's another set of 10, but that is life.
Yeah, that's life. I mean, you're going to make mistakes and you're going to have to deal with them. And that's just how it goes. So
with a little bit of time left, we're going to wind it down as we do every week.
Wind down.
I'm at restaurant Marc Bourgeon with Matt Conway, GM and sommelier, and he's going to talk about how to make the most of your friendships with your sommeliers. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
What do you mean by making the most out of your friendships with sommeliers?
I think now, particularly in the United States, but particularly in New York City, is the perfect time we were specifically speaking millennial generations, but just wine lovers in general, to build relationships with the vast number of wine professionals out there that are actually here to help you find what you love to drink. Mm-hmm. Here at the restaurant, I have a wide range of clientele, customers, friends even, that use me in a lot of different ways. As I was just speaking about, I think one of the most important things for people to remember is you don't have to be a big spender to have a good relationship with a sommelier. And I have a lot of regulars that, frankly, aren't even big wine drinkers. You know, they might be more cocktail drinkers or beer drinkers that have engaged me in conversation and learned a lot about what they do and don't like to drink by just coming into the bar and having a drink, which you might do anywhere. But if you're doing it at a place with a great, friendly beverage professional, you might be able to learn a little bit more about how you like to drink when you dine. Regardless of your age or your experience in any level, the person at the restaurant is getting paid to be that expertise for you. Yeah. And as we just talked about, I find that some people are intimidated by asking for wine help. Just as I was intimidated to be a young sommelier working for a great chef in New York City, I had to rely on people who'd been there before me and had dug the paths for me to be able to do what I do, and I had to learn from them and respect them from a distance because I wasn't working directly under them. And in a restaurant, that's kind of what the sommelier has should have done for you in that context. Like, one of the most interesting things that I come in contact with in today's world is people always think that I like to drink everything on my list, when in reality, I put a lot of stuff on my list that I respect. I think it's well made, but it's not there for me. It's there for somebody else's palate. 2 weeks ago, I had some ladies, a group of four young, pretty ladies that told me that they love to drink Syrah, and they were on their boss's budget, so they were going to be able to drink a little bit, spend a little bit more than they were used to spending. They wanted me to give them the best Syrah that I had. I used that experience to turn them on to their first bottle of Clap Cornas, which they didn't even know that the Northern Rhone was Syrah. So I gatewayed them from California Syrah or Syrah that has Syrah on the label to a bottle of Cornas, which they didn't know was Syrah. And they ended up ordering three bottles for four ladies. And at the end, their mouths were stained dark purple and their teeth were covered in beautiful clap, purple teeth, and they looked up at me and smiled and said, "Wow, this is the best wine we've ever drank in our entire life, and we're super excited to explore the world of Northern Rhone Syrah now that we know that the Northern Rhone is Syrah." And for me, that was an awesome moment as a Syrah lover, as a clap lover, as a sommelier, to take somebody from what they knew to something they didn't know, mm-hmm. and then see those big purple stained smiles looking up at me with the same eyes that I had the first time I tried clap, and just know that their minds were blown and their lives were forever changed, because now they're going to go explore a whole vast region that they never even knew is what they love to drink. I do think that the younger generation is a little bit more easygoing when it comes to what their selections are. I think they're a little bit more trusting of a sommelier or even a server, and they're probably a little bit more willing to try something off the beaten path or something they've never heard of, especially if the price is right.
Yeah.
Whereas I think the older generation sticks a little bit more to known regions, whether it's domestic or, you know, whether it's Napa Valley Cab or whether it's Chablis or Bordeaux, they're more likely to fall in line with what they've known their whole lives. Whereas I think you're more likely to talk, you know, 24 or 20-something into a bottle from the Jura or Savoie or something funky from Northern Italy, or even, you know, Slovenian wine or something that they've never, ever even thought was possible. I think they're a little bit more open-minded, whereas the older generation is still a little bit more stuck in traditional ways.
Thank you, Matt.
My pleasure.
Matt Conway, sommelier at Marc Forgione Restaurant. You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue. And next week in the studio, we'll talk to Jordan Salcido, head beverage director of the Momofuku Group, on making her own wine called Belus, the restaurant that she and husband Robert Bohr co-own, Charlie Bird. And we're going to catch up with her on getting coffee with fashion mogul-ess Tori Burch. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.